This is Mike Roth. Welcome to the Open Forum in the Villages podcast. In this show, we're going to talk to leaders in the community, leaders of clubs, and interesting folks who live here in the Villages to give perspective of what's happening here in the Villages and information that I think all villagers should have. We hope to add a new episode most Fridays at 9 o'clock. This is Mike Roth. I'm here today on Open Forum in the Villages with Dr. Craig Curtis. Thanks for joining me, Craig.
Thank you.
Craig, before we begin, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your background in the field of Alzheimer's?
Sure, Mike. So I'm from Ohio, and then I spent 6 years in the Navy, and then back to Ohio for medical school. And upon graduation, was accepted to the family practice program in Florida, here in Orlando, at Advent Health, which was then known as Florida Hospital. Mm-hmm. And while I was in residency, I got involved in Alzheimer's research in 1997.
Wow, it's a long way back.
It sure is.
Mm-hmm. And exactly what did you do in 1997 for Alzheimer's research?
In 1997, we were still looking at some of the first generation medications, such as Aricept or donepezil, what we call acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. Mm-hmm. And we were using those medications to boost the memory of patients with Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm. Did that work?
It did. We were able to increase their memory approximately 3 to 5%. You'll see different numbers based on different studies, but those medications were sort of early treatments that actually are still in use today.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That's good. Before we get deeper into the show, I wanted to, I always include a joke in the show. So let's include a little joke here. Greg, what do you think they call an ant who fights crime?
I don't know.
A vigilante. Okay, that one was for Evan. Perhaps you could tell our listeners, Craig, the story of Alzheimer's disease.
Sure.
How did it get named and when was it discovered?
Sure. So the story dates back to the 1890s. There was a young patient. Her name was Auguste Dieter, and she was in Germany, and she was married to a railway worker, and she started developing memory loss and behavioral symptoms to the point where she could no longer care for herself. And her family took her to see an esteemed psychiatrist named Dr. Alzheimer. She was admitted to his institution and spent approximately 5 or 6 years there until she passed away. Now, she was only 51 or 52 years old. She was very young. She ended up having early onset Alzheimer's disease. But Dr. Alzheimer's performed an autopsy, and in her brain was the first to report these plaques and tangles that we now consider the hallmark of Alzheimer's disease pathology.
Mm-hmm. I think I understand what a plaque is. What would a tangle be?
Sure. So a plaque is a buildup of this protein called amyloid in Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. And the tangle is a protein called tau that somehow misfolds and starts to actually destroy the brain cells themselves. So the plaque sits outside of the brain cells, and the actual tangles or tau tangles occur inside the brain cells in a patient with Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is, well, maybe you can tell our listeners what you see as the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's.
Would be happy to. So dementia is essentially an umbrella term. There are many, many types of dementia. Alzheimer's disease is the number one type of dementia. I like to tell my patients, if I drove here in a car would be dementia. And then if I told you it was a Ford F-150, then that would be the type of car or the type of, in Alzheimer's disease, it would be the type of dementia. But there are many, many forms of dementia. Mm-hmm. Such as vascular dementia, which are little tiny strokes that can happen. There is dementia from Parkinson's disease, Lewy body dementia, frontotemporal dementia, and many, many other forms. But Alzheimer's disease makes up approximately 75% of cases of dementia. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
So how common is dementia?
Dementia is very, very quite common. Currently, really? We have about 6 million Americans in the United States with dementia. And by 2050, if we don't find a way to slow it down or cure Alzheimer's disease or dementia, we will have approximately 13 to 14 million patients with dementia.
So you said that about 70% of the dementia that we see is Alzheimer's. How do you diagnostically tell the difference between Alzheimer's and the other 30% of the dementia cases?
Sure. So Dementia is a clinical term, and it simply means progressive memory loss to the point where someone is unable to care for themselves. When it comes to Alzheimer's disease or looking at the different dementias, we look at the onset of the dementia, how it started, what type of symptoms. For example, in classic Alzheimer's disease, we usually see short-term memory loss as the initial sign, whereas in someone who might be developing Parkinson's disease, we would see motor movements or problems with fine motor skills, or in someone with potentially Lou Gehrig's disease, which is another which doesn't ALS. Cause dementia, but exactly, but is another form of a neurodegenerative disease. We would see somebody with ascending muscle weakness or other problems such as that.
Is multiple sclerosis in the same family?
No, it is not.
Okay. I was unaware of Lou Gehrig's disease being part of this family.
It doesn't cause dementia, but Lou Gehrig's disease shares sort of a similar pathology in the fact that it's a misfolded protein that clumps together in the wrong place at the wrong time. And in Lou Gehrig's disease, this happens in the spinal cord, whereas in Alzheimer's disease, we see this bad protein or this abnormal protein that clumps together, and that occurs in the memory part of the brain called the hippocampus. And in a disease such as Parkinson's disease, we see a clumping together of a different protein in the motor part of the brain.
Mm-hmm. So in Parkinson's, people get dementia as well?
Most patients with Parkinson's disease do end up getting some form of dementia.
And here in the villages, are those statistics 70-30 kind of been holding true for you? 70% of the people that come in with a problem have Alzheimer's, and the other 30% have a different form of dementia?
Well, actually, that does hold true here in the villages, that it's approximately 70-30. Yes, sir.
And with the cases of Alzheimer's, since we're talking about Alzheimer's today, is Alzheimer's an inherited disease that you get from your parents or other people in your extended family, or is it a...
sporadic.
Well, environmentally caused disease.
I see. So Alzheimer's disease, we know that roughly 30 to 40% are related to genes, and about 60% are what we call sporadic Alzheimer's disease.
In other words, there was no family history of anyone in the family coming down with Alzheimer's, but this one person did.
That's correct. And in addition, we do not find any genetic links or genetic markers in that particular patient. Correct.
Are there any food or dietary indications from maybe worldwide studies that indicate a certain eating style of certain foods will diminish the probability of Alzheimer's developing or halting the progress of it?
Well, we have had studies using primarily Mediterranean diets, or what we call the MIND diet, which is a combination of the Mediterranean diet and the DASH antihypertensive diet. So those two have been combined into what they call the MIND diet, M-I-N-D. And that's it's a much simpler diet to follow than a true Mediterranean diet. And in that diet, foods are essentially broken down into 10 healthy groups of foods and 5 unhealthy groups of foods. And the 10 healthy groups of foods are really the ones we'd want you to follow. And scientifically, that the MIND diet has been shown to lead to patients doing better on memory testing, on cognitive testing. The more strictly they can follow the MIND diet, the better they will do in memory testing.
So what is on the MIND diet?
Lots of healthy foods, such as fish, chicken, low amounts of red meat, blueberries.
And what's on the 5 foods that were bad for the MIND?
Foods with high contents of butter and saturated fat. So foods we know that, and unfortunately red meat as well. Lots of red meat would be against the MIND diet.
And when someone goes on the MIND diet and stays strictly on the MIND's diet as much as you can in America, what kind of results do you see?
So there were some large studies done out of Rush University in Chicago, where they looked at following a group of people, and they would follow how closely, they would adhere to the MIND diet over years, and then they would bring them in for memory testing. And what they found was that those that were able to stick to the MIND diet, and the stronger they could stick to the MIND diet, the better they did in cognitive testing. It does not answer the question, though, whether or not this prevents or stops Alzheimer's disease, but we do know that that is probably a very healthy diet for the brain itself.
Mm-hmm. Was there a control group in this study?
Essentially, the control group was, as they would ask the patients how closely they followed the MIND diet. Mm-hmm. So the control group essentially became the subjects who reported following the MIND diet the least.
Mm. Okay. Okay. Sounds logical. And over how many years did you say that was study was
I
done?
I believe it was a 5-year study.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do we know any of the causes, the root causes of Alzheimer's?
So I think the predominant theory of Alzheimer's disease that most of the scientific community is following is that Alzheimer's disease is a buildup of a protein called amyloid that is a normal protein in the brain, but this protein misfolds and starts to clump together and form these little plaques outside of the brain cells. And then that leads to the brain cells breaking down and tau becoming phosphorylated inside of the cell and breaking down. So it's called the amyloid cascade theory of Alzheimer's disease, mm-hmm. and it is the predominant theory. And we can now show that by reducing amyloid, we are starting to slow the progression of clinical Alzheimer's disease. And that's been shown in a couple of recent trials, clinical trials.
Mm-hmm. So can Alzheimer's disease be prevented with these medicines?
Well, that's what we're exploring right now. There is currently a significant number of prevention trials going on around the country, and based on the theory that if we can remove amyloid, then we could potentially slow the progression into Alzheimer's disease. So a lot of these studies essentially look for patients that don't have any symptoms, mm-hmm. yet a simple blood test or a PET scan shows that they have amyloid, or amyloid in their brain in the case of the PET scan. And therefore, if they go on a medication that removes amyloid, we might be able to prevent them from going into full-blown Alzheimer's disease.
So if you look at a PET scan of a 25-year-old, will you find these amyloids in their brain?
Generally not in a 25-year-old. However, there is early onset Alzheimer's disease, which August Dieter, Dr. Alzheimer's patient, actually had. And these patients get Alzheimer's disease in their 30s and 40s. Thankfully, it's rare, but we've learned a lot from those patients, actually. And we have about 5 to 10,000 of those patients in the United States with early onset Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm. And on average, at what age does Alzheimer's begin to raise its ugly head?
Generally, about age 75 to 85, we mm-hmm. start to see patients with symptoms. However, there are some genetic risk factors, such as a gene called ApoE. And if someone has an ApoE4/4, they get one from their mom, one from their dad, one copy of each. If they have that, their risk is significantly higher, and we start to see symptoms in their mid-60s if they're an ApoE4/4. Patient, which we can test with a simple saliva test, or we can test for with a simple saliva test or a blood test.
And is this the test that they were talking about in today's Daily Sun?
ApoE would be a part of that test, yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other gene tests or blood tests that they can do to help determine if this is an Alzheimer's case or a different type of dementia?
Yes, that's probably one of the hottest areas in research. And this research is going on all over the world. At our last International Alzheimer's meeting, we had approximately 85 to 90 countries represented by 10,000 scientists. So there's a lot of research going on around the world looking into blood tests. And there's a couple that seem to stand out, one of them actually being tau, mm-hmm. and there's a certain tau called 217 that we look for in the blood. And that one seems to be a very good marker for Alzheimer's disease. But there's a couple other different blood tests that are out there, including one that's FDA approved, that you can actually get this test done, and it tests for amyloid in the brain, not for tau. So we're really focusing in on testing for amyloid and tau, and we call those biomarkers. Mm-hmm. And those blood tests can simply tell us that they're present, and then generally on a PET scan, we can then quantify how much is there in the brain.
Mm-hmm. When I was talking to Dr. Mohammed Amir of Avi, he said that some people who have these plaques in their brain show no symptoms of Alzheimer's. I was very confused by that.
Well, a lot of the medical community is confused by that. So that is true. We do see a subset of patients that have amyloid in their brain that don't have tau. And tau really signifies the destruction is taking place. Mm-hmm. And we don't know if it's because those patients simply haven't moved into the next stage yet. Mm-hmm. Or why they are developing amyloid but not developing tau. But that's a very small subset of patients, but that is true. That does occur.
Let's talk a little bit about the drug treatments that are available for patients that are more or less positively identified as Alzheimer's patients.
Sure.
What's available for them?
So the first drugs were approved back in the early 90s, and those were drugs that increased a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine mm-hmm. in the brain. And acetylcholine is used in memory formation. And so by boosting acetylcholine in the brain, we were able to allow patients to have around 3-5% of their memory spared. However,
doesn't seem like a heck of an effective treatment if it's only 3-5%.
A very good point. And there's been a lot of talk that these medicines are statistically significant, but not clinically significant. But we still use those medications as first-line therapy in a patient diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. We still use acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. Mm-hmm. And another drug that we use a lot is called memantine. And that came around in the early 2000s. And that medication essentially quiets the brain from misfiring. We see that a lot in early Alzheimer's disease, that the brain misfires. And this quiets the brain and allows you to remember a little better. So then recently, about 2 years ago, we had the world's first drug approved by the FDA that actually reduces the amyloid and tau in your brain, mm-hmm. those biomarkers.
Those sound good.
The FDA approved that medication. That showed a significant improvement in the biomarkers, the amyloid and tau, yet did not show an improvement clinically. But it did show an improvement clinically in a small subset of patients. So there are further studies going on with that medication mm-hmm. called Aduhelm or aducanumab.
And then is that the terribly expensive medication that Medicare hasn't approved for payment?
That is correct. They'll only pay for it in a clinical trial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And are there a lot of other drugs in clinical trials that show promise?
There actually are. Currently, as of 2022, we have about 150 different medications being studied for Alzheimer's disease. And this requires about 50,000 patients to go through these trials to test these medications. And we do have a couple of medications that have been tested over the past few years that seem to be showing some promise. In fact, the world's first drug to actually show a slowing of clinical decline was just released about a month and a half ago.
Really?
The drug is still going to need to be FDA approved and go through some final testing, but it looks like we're getting close to being able to slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. We don't think it's a cure, but we think if we can slow the progression, we'll make some strong headwinds in the disease.
Well, that seems like a step in the right direction. Has any drug company come out and said that they're working on a medicine to reverse the symptoms of Alzheimer's?
Well, that's a strong word, reverse the symptoms of Alzheimer's in our field. We take baby steps when it comes to brain research. Mm-hmm. I think we're all hopeful that we'll find a medication to reverse Alzheimer's disease, but I don't think we're going to be there for a while to actually take a patient, for example, that has severe Alzheimer's disease and bring them back to the way they functioned before they had Alzheimer's disease. I would say we're multiple decades away from being able to do something like that. Our main goal right now is to slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease or prevent people from moving into Alzheimer's disease if they have amyloid in their brain.
Mm-hmm. So when you compare the population of population in America, we have different subgroups here, to subgroups that are similar to them genetically from other regions of the world, which naturally have different diets. What has science discovered about that?
Well, unfortunately for Americans, we've discovered that our diet is probably one of the worst, that we tend to have higher rates of obesity and high blood pressure in the U.S., which leads to damage, brain damage for short, but essentially it damages the small blood vessels, and we have a lot of small blood vessels in the brain. That leads to a lot of what we call microvascular disease in the brain, which doesn't cause Alzheimer's, we believe, but it probably sets the brain up for pretty bad things to happen. So if you were to get it, it would make it that much stronger or that much more aggressive.
Those things commonly referred to as mini strokes.
Mini strokes would be exactly. And potentially, if there is enough of them, we could call that vascular dementia. But to answer that question,
but vascular dementia, again, is not Alzheimer's. So is there a different treatment for vascular dementia?
So the treatment for vascular would be maintaining vascular health by proper diet, exercise, controlling blood sugar, controlling, if you have diabetes, controlling your blood pressure as well. So anything that makes the vasculature stronger, we definitely would want people to embark on exercise programs as well, once that's approved by their doctor.
How about these other ways to improve your brain that predominate in the internet? I once found a list of 50 things you could do to prevent or stop Alzheimer's, things like mind puzzles, games, breathing, or my absolute favorite is walking in wet grass to ground yourself.
I haven't heard that one. That's a good one. So I think that what we have to talk about, though, is brain health versus preventing or stopping Alzheimer's disease. So when we talk about keeping your brain active, involved in crossword puzzles, walking in nature, walking outside, going for a hike, really good things to keep your brain healthy, which could potentially help you keep a healthier brain, that if you were to get Alzheimer's disease, it could potentially lead to it being slightly slower on its course. But I don't like to talk about those things in the context of stopping or preventing Alzheimer's disease, because we have no hard science that would actually prevent or stop Alzheimer's disease. But the science does show keeping your brain active and healthy will keep your brain healthy and stronger.
Let me ask you one question, which is a little weird, maybe. Is keeping your body in shape, do you find that people who have exercised regularly, gone to the gym 3 to 5 days a week, kept their weight down, improved their or maintained their muscular muscles to be a group that has fewer cases of Alzheimer's than the general population, which doesn't go to a gym on a regular basis?
So that's a great question, and it's being actively studied. Well, it's so there's some great research going on in that field in exercise and whether it will slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease. And there's some interesting case reports of essentially marathon runners that develop Alzheimer's disease and how slow they progress with their Alzheimer's disease compared to a non-marathon runner or sort of the average American that gets Alzheimer's disease. So I think that the science is really hard to prove that it actually would prevent or stop or delay, but there does seem to be very strong cases out there that lend weight to the fact that if you can exercise frequently, any kind of exercise that gets your heart rate up can be very positive and healthy for your brain. And potentially those over-exercisers or those people such as marathon runners, there is possibility that something like that may help slow some of the progression because your brain is so healthy from all the exercise.
So in your opinion, would you say doing exercise 3 times a week is better than sitting down for 2 hours every other day and reading a book?
I would definitely say to keep your brain healthy, you should exercise approximately 5 times a week.
5 times a week.
20 to 30 minutes.
And for our villagers here, would you say pickleball is a good exercise?
I would say pickleball is an amazingly good exercise.
Really?
Yes. They're moving. They're active. You can sweat playing pickleball. Mm-hmm. I've played it myself. I think it's a great sport.
Great. Is there anything else you want to add, Dr. Curtis?
No, I think we about covered it.
Great. Thanks for being part of the Forum in the Villages. And if anything else comes up on your horizon new in Alzheimer's that you want our listeners to find out about, give me a call and we'll get you on the air again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Remember, our next episode will air live Friday at 9 a.m., or should I say pre-recorded, but that's when it'll be released on our regular subscriptions. Bonus subscribers can get early access to episodes. Should you want to become a sponsor of the show, contact me at mikeroth@rothvoice.com. If you know someone that you think should be on the show, send me an email at mike@rothvoice.com. I want to thank everyone for listening to the show. The content of the show is copyright by Roth Voice 2022, all rights reserved.